There's a seemingly simple question that, it really challenges how we understand the modern world. Why did South Korea get immensely rich over the last few decades while Bolivia didn't?
Yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate puzzle, right? You look at the mid-20th century and you have these two nations facing just massive existential challenges.
Right, both trying to build a modern economy basically from the ground up.
Exactly. And then you fast forward to today and the economic realities of those two countries, well, they couldn't be more different.
Yeah, and on the surface, this sounds like the exact kind of thing an economist should be able to answer. I mean, figuring out how wealth is generated and how nations develop is basically their core job description.
You would think so. But what if the field of economics is structurally incapable of answering it?
Structurally incapable. Okay, that is a huge
It's
claim.
a provocative thought, sure, but it's exactly the debate happening at the highest levels of economic theory right now. It's less about a lack of data and more a fundamental crisis over how we actually measure historical success.
Which brings us to the source material for today's deep dive. We're looking at a recent excerpt from the newsletter No Opinion, written by the economist Noah Smith.
Right, and he's responding to a pretty sharp critique by another economist, Jesus Fernandez Villaverde, who usually just goes by JFE.
Yeah, JFE. And he essentially claimed that the entire field of development economics has lost its way.
Completely lost its way. He's arguing they've abandoned the massive, consequential questions like that South Korea versus Bolivia puzzle we just mentioned.
And instead, they're getting completely lost in the methodological weeds.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this. In this deep dive, we're going to explore this tension right at the heart of global economics. We'll look at the clash between studying highly measurable, localized poverty programs versus, massive, messy historical growth.
And ultimately, we're going to look at why the mathematical tools we rely on to understand the world might actually be broken.
Right. So starting with JFE's critique, what's his core issue with modern development economists?
Well, his main argument is that development economics is ignoring what he calls the big questions. And by that, he means industrialization, long-term national growth, basically the macro-level forces that actually lift an entire nation out of poverty.
Instead of what they're doing now,
Right.
which is what.
Instead, he argues the field has become utterly obsessed with randomized controlled trials, RCTs. They're focusing on these highly specific micro-level programs.
And for you listening, you probably know RCTs are kind of the gold standard for testing specific interventions in the field right now. Economists use them to test things like whether giving unconditional cash transfers in one specific Kenyan village compared to a control village increases school attendance.
Or local business starts, yeah. They're highly rigorous.
Very rigorous.
But this critique isn't entirely new. Lant Pritchett, he's a very prominent voice in development. He made almost the exact same argument back in 2019.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He heavily criticized the Nobel-winning economists who championed these RCT methods. He actually called them the randomistas.
Randomistas. Okay, it's catchy, but I have to push back on this critique right out of the gate. Because, I mean, the whole point of the credibility revolution in economics was to stop guessing and start proving what actually works.
Right.
So if an RCT proves that a specific microloan program works, isn't that exactly what we should be focusing on, just building from the ground up?
And that's the standard defense for RCTs. Absolutely. You get hard empirical proof. But, and this is a big but, here's the counter argument Pritchett brought to the table. According to his data, all of these specific targeted poverty programs combined account for less than 1% of the variation in actual global poverty reduction.
Wait, less than 1%?
Less than
Then for
1%.
how?
I know.
Okay.
The real driver of poverty reduction isn't a clever microloan program or, giving up bed nets. It's broad national economic growth.
Right.
When a country's GDP grows substantially over decades, poverty plummets.
That makes sense.
What's fascinating here is the stark disconnect. You have incredibly brilliant minds, literally winning Nobel Prizes for perfecting the methodology of studying poverty interventions.
Right.
And yet critics are arguing they're analyzing the statistical noise while completely missing the engine that actually drives global wealth.
Let me see if I'm tracking the scale of this. Is this like trying to understand how to win a Formula One race by endlessly studying the tread compound on a single tire
Oh, I like this.
while completely ignoring the aerodynamics and the actual power unit?
That's a really solid way to look at it. And to take your F1 analogy a step further, imagine if the telemetry engineers studying that tire tread were so obsessed with getting the exact wear data that they actively refuse to look under the hood.
Because the engine is just too complicated to measure perfectly.
Exactly. JFE and Pritchett are essentially standing in the pit lane, yelling at everyone to look at the engine.
Okay, but Noah Smith reads this critique from JFE, and he doesn't just roll over, right? He pushes back with a lot of nuance.
He does.
If JFE is saying no one is studying the engine, Noah basically says, hey, look at the Nobel laureates.
Right. Noah points out that the claim that no one is studying macro development is just empirically false. There are massive, highly active research programs entirely dedicated to these exact questions. He brings the receipts.
He really does list them out. And before we dive into some of these theories, just a quick aside for you listening. Some of the ideas we're about to cover touch on highly debated, politically charged concepts.
Yeah, like the legacy of colonialism or the definition of free markets.
Exactly. So we're strictly reporting on the historical frameworks these economists use in their research. We're not endorsing any specific political ideology or taking a side here. Our goal is just to understand the mechanics of the arguments Noah Smith references.
And the mechanics are incredibly deep. For instance, Noah points to Darren Acemoglu's work on institutions. Acemoglu argues that the legal and political structures of a country dictate its long-term wealth.
Can you break down how that actually works in practice? Because, you know, institutions is a pretty vague word.
Sure. So Acemoglu divides institutions into inclusive and extractive.
Okay.
An inclusive institution might be strong, impartial property rights. If you invent a new manufacturing process in a country with inclusive institutions, you know the government won't just seize your factory.
Right, so that incentivizes you to invest and grow.
Exactly. Extractive institutions, on the other hand, are designed to funnel wealth from the general population to a small elite. So think of colonial resource extraction or just deep state corruption.
Right.
Over centuries, those incentive structures completely diverge a nation's trajectory.
That makes a lot of sense. And then Noah mentions the geography argument, which Jared Diamond made famous in Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Right. And the mechanism there isn't just having good soil. Diamond argued that the physical orientation of a continent matters.
Hmm.
Eurasia has a long east-west axis.
Meaning crops and domesticated animals could spread easily across similar latitudes and climates.
Exactly. But Africa and the Americas have north-south axis, meaning huge climate variations that basically blocked the spread of agricultural technology. It's a geographical structural advantage that compounded over millennia.
And the list Noah provides just keeps going. You have Gary Becker and Robert Lucas studying human capital, how investing in the education and health of a population creates compounding returns.
You have Donnie Roderick studying industrialism, looking at how shifting labor from agriculture to manufacturing creates these massive productivity jumps.
Right, and Joel Mokering looking at how culture, the attitude towards scientific inquiry during the Enlightenment spurred the Industrial Revolution.
He even brings up Milton Friedman's focus on economic liberalism alongside other massive macro concepts like state capacity, which is literally a government's ability to enforce laws and collect taxes.
And Alberto Alesina's work on national cohesion.
Yeah, so that is a comprehensive assault on the big macro questions of development.
It's a literal army of macroeconomists. So Noah's point is that the field isn't actually neglecting the engine.
No, not at all. And he brings data to debunk the idea that RCTs are taking over the field too.
Oh, right. The numbers from 2022.
Yeah, only 19% of development economics papers actually use randomized trials. In field journals, it's just 13%.
Which means roughly 80% of development economics is not using these micro-level trials.
Exactly. Noah makes a very pragmatic point here. Even if you somehow forced all 19% of those RCT researchers to switch entirely to macro questions, the marginal increase in effort would be a drop in the bucket.
The field wouldn't suddenly transform and solve global poverty overnight.
Exactly.
Okay, but if that's true, I'm genuinely confused now.
Why?
Because if the RCTs aren't actually hogging all the resources and we have this massive cohort of Nobel-winning researchers actively studying geography, culture, institutions, state capacity, human capital, why are economists like JFV still complaining?
Why?
I mean, why haven't we solved the Korea versus Bolivia puzzle yet? We clearly have the brain power focused on the right questions.
That is the pivotal question of the entire debate. And the uncomfortable truth that Noah Smith arrives at is this. The problem isn't the focus of the economists. The problem is that the mathematical tools of modern economics are fundamentally incapable of parsing history.
Wow. So it's not about what they're looking at. It's the lens they're looking through. The tools themselves are broken when applied at this scale.
Exactly. Let's look really closely at the South Korea example to understand why the tools fail. To explain why South Korea succeeded, you have to untangle an incredibly complex web of interacting variables.
Right. The source material lists these out, and it's kind of dizzying. South Korea had an intense cultural focus on education. They built an aggressively export-driven economy.
They had a deeply strategic relationship with the United States, which gave them access to massive consumer markets.
Plus, they had a high degree of ethnic homogeneity, which might have lowered internal political friction.
They developed a very strong, highly capable bureaucracy. They had excellent access to the sea for global trade. They benefited from the transfer of Japanese industrial know-how.
And crucially, they had the unifying existential military threat of North Korea right on their border, which basically forced massive state coordination.
Right. Here's where it gets really interesting. Because every single one of those factors plausibly drove their success. And they all interact.
Yeah. The U.S. relationship funded the export economy. The North Korean threat forced the state capacity to improve, which then managed the industrial policy. It's a giant knot.
It is. So how does an economist mathematically prove which variable was the main driver?
They can't.
They can't. That is the fundamental impossibility of isolation in macroeconomics. You cannot isolate causation because history gives us a sample size of exactly one.
Sample size of one.
Right. South Korea's rise was a singular historical event. You can't rewind the 20th century, take away their access to the sea while holding everything else perfectly constant, and measure the difference in their 2024 GDP.
It's like trying to perfectly recreate a complicated grandmother's recipe. But every time you try to bake the cake, the oven changes its own temperature. The ingredients magically alter their chemical composition halfway through gravity shifts. And you only get to taste the result once. You can guess what made it taste good, but you can't prove it in a lab.
That's spot on. The kitchen is always changing. And when you take that changing kitchen to the macroeconomic level, you see exactly why the traditional toolkit falls apart. Let's walk through the main tool economists try to use to solve this. First, you have cross-country regressions.
This is where they take a massive data set of like 100 different countries, put variables in a spreadsheet, and look for correlations.
Right? Yes. But cross-country regressions are crippled by what economists call endogeneity.
Endogeneity.
Yeah, it's basically a massive, mathematically unsolvable chicken or egg problem.
Give me an example of how endogeneity breaks the math.
Okay, take Acemoglu's theory on institutions. An economist might run a regression and find a strong correlation between strong property rights and high GDP.
Which seems obvious. Strong property rights cause wealth.
It seems obvious. But endogeneity asks, wait, what if getting rich is what allows a country to afford the expensive courts, police, and bureaucrats required to enforce property rights in the first place?
Oh, the arrow of causality goes both ways.
Exactly. A regression just sees the correlation. It can't tell you which one sparked the other. Furthermore, the sample sizes are too small, and nations are too incomparable. You can't cleanly line up the historical variables of Bolivia with the historical variables of a post-war Asian peninsula.
That makes total sense. Okay, what about structural models? Because we hear a lot about economic modeling.
So structural models are systems of complex mathematical equations designed to simulate an economy. But Noah points out, they are inherently unfalsifiable.
Unfalsifiable, meaning they can't be proven wrong. How is that possible if it's based on math?
Because the economist builds the model and sets the parameters themselves. If they build a model to explain South Korea's growth, and the model's output doesn't match historical GDP well, the economist just goes back into the math and tweaks a parameter.
Like, let's adjust the friction in the labor market.
Exactly. They adjust it until the model fits the historical data perfectly. But that's just curve fitting. Tweaking the math until it matches the past doesn't prove that your specific theory of labor friction was the actual real-world cause.
You're just forcing the puzzle piece to fit. So regressions are caught in a chicken and egg loop, and structural models are just elaborate curve fitting. What about just using narrative history?
Narrative history is vital. It gives you the full story of the U.S. relationship, the exports, the education system. But history is qualitative. It relies on interpretation. It cannot mathematically assign a definitive percentage of causation to each factor.
And finally, we're back to where we started with JFV's critique, the microeconomic RCTs, the field trials.
Which give you perfect causality, but absolutely zero scale. You can scientifically prove that giving out textbooks improved test scores in one district in the 1990s, but you cannot scale that finding to explain the entire industrialization of a nation of 50 million people over 40 years.
So we really do have this massive puzzle. The tools are fundamentally broken for the task at hand. The F1 car is tearing down the track, and our telemetry is basically useless for understanding the engine. Where does that leave the entire field of macro development economics?
It leads Noah Smith to a very sobering conclusion.
Yeah.
He states that there is no strict science of development, and there likely never will be.
Wow. That's a huge concession. It's basically acknowledging that development economics isn't a hard science like physics or chemistry.
And maybe it shouldn't pretend to be.
Yeah.
Noah's saying that economists need to stop acting like they have the definitive, infallible blueprint for prosperity. If the mathematical tools can't definitively untangle the past, they certainly can't mathematically guarantee the future.
So what's their new job description then? If they aren't the hard scientists of human prosperity, providing exact formulas for growth, what are they supposed to do?
Noah suggests they should act more like expert guides. Their role is to synthesize these massive, complex theories like Acemoglu's institutions or Diamond's geography and explain them to policymakers to give them a mental framework.
Sort of pointing out historical failures to help leaders avoid repeating catastrophic mistakes.
Exactly. And they should analyze successful historical cases like South Korea or Poland to provide loose templates and inspiration. But the key operating principle, above all else, has to be humility.
Humility, not exactly the first trait that comes to mind when you think of elite academia advising global governments.
No, it's really not. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, letting go of the need for perfect, mathematical certainty is actually a much healthier way to approach policy.
How so?
It allows for a more pragmatic, grounded approach to learning from history. Instead of stubbornly searching for an impossible silver bullet, policymakers can look at the messy reality of what actually happened, acknowledge the uncertainty, and draw cautious, intelligent lessons.
So, what does this all mean for the future of the field? Are economists basically just historians with math degrees now? Is the puzzle of how nations get rich just permanently unsolvable?
Well, Noah does leave one tiny futuristic window open.
Right, the AI thing.
He suggests that this problem will remain unsolvable by humans, but throws out a caveat about artificial intelligence. The implication is that untangling the South Korea versus Bolivia puzzle requires processing an almost infinite number of interacting variables across decades.
A level of pattern recognition that human cognition, even aided by our best statistical models, just can't handle.
Exactly. It might only be achievable when a highly advanced AI can look at the entirety of human history from a true bird's-eye view and finally untangle the knot of causality.
That is wild to think about. Okay, let's wrap this up because we've covered a tremendous amount of ground today. For everyone listening, we started by wondering why one country thrives while another struggles. We explored a massive turf war inside economics between researchers studying highly measurable micro-level poverty programs and macroeconomists studying the massive historical forces of national growth.
And we discovered that despite having brilliant minds and robust theories, the mathematical tools we use, whether it's cross-country regressions or structural models, are simply inadequate for isolating causality in a sample size of one.
Right. And there's a huge practical takeaway here that applies directly to you and your own life. Whether you're trying to figure out why a specific company succeeded when its competitors failed, or why a certain cultural trend suddenly took off, you have to remember the Korea versus Bolivia problem. Beware of any guru or consultant who confidently claims to have found the single silver bullet for success. Because in any complex system, whether it's a global economy or your local industry, causation is incredibly elusive. The variables are always interacting, and the recipe is always changing.
This raises an important question, though, one that pushes us past economics and straight into human nature.
Oh, I like the sound of this. Where are we going?
Think about that futuristic AI Noah Smith mentioned.
Okay.
Imagine that day actually arrives. The AI gets that bird's-eye view of human society, crunches the infinite variables of history, and prints out the exact, infallible step-by-step formula for a country to become rich and prosperous. It hands us the perfect blueprint.
The ultimate answer.
Right, here's the question you have to ask yourself. Would human politicians actually be willing to implement it? Or would the messy, irrational reality of human ego, short-term politics, and entrenched power dynamics immediately break the perfect model all over again?
Now that is something to chew on.